Hard to Believe is proud to be a part of the Cage Club Podcast Network. For more episodes of this show, head to cageclub.me/believe. And to check out other great shows, head to cageclub.me. If you have an idea for a show topic, would like to be a guest, want to tell me how much you like the show, or how much you hate it, or just want to say hi, send me an email, john@cageclub.me. That's john@cageclub.me. Hey everyone, this is our last episode of Season 1. Before we get into it, I'd like to take a minute to thank some people. Starting with my brilliant friends who lent their voices in support to the show. Joey Lewandowski, Mike Manzi, Teddy Smith, Jess Collins, Juhi Gamani, and Matt Williams. I also want to thank all my guests for so generously sharing their insights and wisdom. I want to thank one guest in particular, J.W. Rinsler. Last summer, he agreed to talk to me and Juhi initially about the Alien saga. But as I learned more about his remarkable career and his fascination with space travel and dreaming to do the impossible, we soon found ourselves exploring much different terrain. Neither Juhi nor I knew at the time, but J.W. was struggling with health difficulties that would soon be diagnosed as stage 4 pancreatic cancer. Despite this, he was never anything but utterly generous of time and spirit. He's fighting the good fight and remains optimistic, and he's responding well to treatment, and we all wish him a steady return to health. If you'd like to help, you can show your support by purchasing his labor of love, the terrific novel All Up, wherever books are sold. Give it to a loved one for Christmas, and know your generosity will be doubly appreciated. I also want to thank you all for your interest, questions, and positive feedback. We have a lot planned for Season 2, and I'm really excited about it, so stay tuned, because we'll be back in the spring with brand new episodes. But for our final episode of the season, I thought I'd go back to the theme that somehow came to drive so many of the season's episodes. We began the season looking at the lasting legacy of the X-Files and how the landscape of conspiracy theories in the 1990s contrasted with those of today. Conspiracy theories have always been fascinating to me, as I'm as curious as I am skeptical. I'm not inclined to believe in them, but I'm certainly inclined to understand them. And so we address topics like the disappearance of the Ninth Legion, the role the Antichrist plays in conspiracies, the Satanic Panic, the theory that Hitler survived and fled to South America, and of course, QAnon. So closing the season right before Christmas, it only seemed right to examine history's most successful actual conspiracy. That of hundreds of millions of parents the world over, duping their children by willing into existence a magical elf man who flies on a sleigh delivering presents for free to all good children. My guest today is Jerry Boulder. I'm John Brooks. This is Hard to Believe. Well, Jerry Boulder, welcome, and thank you for joining the show. You have made a whole career out of, I know you wouldn't say it's a single day, but out of basically covering one particular day of the year, and that, of course, is Christmas. So I just want to start by asking you this question. What is so appealing to you about Christmas that you have had this sort of lifelong fascination with it?
Well, I didn't start off as a Christmas expert. I'm a historian, and I started off in 16th century political theory, particularly the belief that it's okay to assassinate evil rulers. And I wasn't getting much traction with that. And you don't get invited to very many parties. So when I did get invited to a party, a Christmas party, and asked to bring a little historical something or other, I did a little history of Christmas, and it was so fascinating, and the reception was so good that I took 10 years and wrote the World Encyclopedia of Christmas. So I'm now, I guess, in my 30th year of studying this enormously fascinating topic, 2,000 years of feasting and fighting and baking and decorating and giving and arguing. There's an unending, I'll never even scratch the surface of it, I think.
Have you found yourself becoming more kind of personally Christmassy throughout your daily life throughout the year as you've been?
Yeah, absolutely. I've always loved Christmas. I had lovely Christmases as a child. but I play Christmas music all year. I do something Christmassy every day. Starting in December, the house is literally covered in everything you could imagine.
So I wanted to talk to you about Santa Claus. This is an area that I've always been fascinated by. The very complicated story of this kind of cultural icon and how he came to sort of take center stage in the Christmas story. My perception from people that I talk to is basically if you ask people where Santa Claus comes from, it's one of two things. They either say he's based on St. Nicholas of Myra, or Coca-Cola invented him. And I'm pretty sure that you would make the case that neither of those are either the true story or the full picture. So you wrote a biography of a fictional character, which first of all must be quite a challenge. But tell us the story. Let's start with this. Where would you argue is sort of, if there is a single starting point to the Santa Claus figure, where is it? Is it St. Nicholas or is it somewhere else?
It has to be St. Nicholas, because he is the first and longest enduring of the Christmas gift bringers. Before the St. Nicholas cult of the Middle Ages, nobody was magically bringing gifts to children during the Christmas season. Now, the story of how he came to be that guy has centuries of prehistory. Nicholas of Myra was a Christian bishop, we think, of the early 300s. He is said to have appeared at the very important Council of Nicaea in 325. And very shortly after his death, all kinds of legends are built on him. And he becomes the most important saint outside of the Virgin Mary. It's hard to grasp just how important he was in the everyday lives of the Christian world. Hundreds and hundreds of churches dedicated to him. He's the patron saint of Russia, infinite number of cities. Most importantly, professions. He's particularly the patron saint of seagoers and fishermen. And the Mediterranean world depended on him. It was believed that he could fly, because he seemed to fly to rescue sailors at sea. He has the power of bilocation. He can be in several places at once. He has an intense interest in justice, protecting the unjustly accused and the downtrodden. He's full of mercy. A couple of stories out of dozens and dozens are important to his legend. The first, I think most people will have heard of, and that is that as a young man of a wealthy family, he had heard that a father was going to have to sell his daughters into prostitution because he could not afford a dowry for them. So Nicholas slipped into the house, usually through a window, bags of gold to pay for the daughters' dowries. And so he becomes associated with surreptitious gift giving. The story that is more famous in the Middle Ages is the one where he goes into an inn and senses that something is wrong. The innkeeper has murdered three students and chopped up their bodies and pickled them in barrels down the basement and is going to serve them in kind of a cannibal feast. So Nicholas goes and resurrects the three boys, and churches all across Europe will be decorated with little images of three boys emerging from a tub. So he becomes the patron saint of children. And sometime around 1200, the legend starts that he visits the homes of good children, and drops little gifts in their shoes on the eve of his feast day, December 6th. So from that point, there's a huge St. Nicholas child Christmas cult that explodes. Parents and the church seize on this. We have prayers and songs to St. Nicholas asking him to bring gifts. We have St. Nicholas fairs where toy makers and bakers provide the necessities for this cult. And over the centuries, he gets a reputation as being generous, but also extremely strict, that he will either appear with a shaggy, dark helper at Christmas time to question kids as to their behavior. Have they learned the requisite prayers? Have they done good deeds? If they have, then good things happen to the kids. And if not, St. Nicholas or his helper might well thrash them on the spot. So he has this very judgmental side. And he is a big part of the spiritual economy of Europe until the 1500s, when Protestantism begins, and with it an attack on the cult of saints. So Protestants don't want any intermediaries between themselves and God. So they abolish the veneration of saints, the observation of saints' days, and in much of Europe, St. Nicholas is given the boot. Now this this causes a domestic crisis, because kids, parents have gotten used to this lovely ritual of surreptitious Christmas gift giving. So we need a substitute for St. Nicholas, and Protestants come up with the Christ child.
Right.
That's Christian. God is the source of everything that's good, so it's natural to assume that the baby Jesus comes on his eve, December 24th, and brings gifts. Now, the problem with the baby Jesus is that, A, he's not scary, so he lacks that threatening demeanor that St. Nicholas had, and he can't carry baskets, gifts, bags. So the Christ child is then given a shaggy helper, like St. Nicholas used to have. And interestingly, these scary helpers, they'll be clad in furs and their face will be smutted and they'll be carrying chains or whips or baskets to take evil kids away in. They're given names that harken back to Nicholas. So Belsnickel, Nicholas in furs.
Right.
Aschenklaus, Nicholas in ashes. So in Protestant countries, particularly Germany, some parts of France, that's what you get. In England, nothing. St. Nicholas is gone. He has no replacement at all for centuries. But the critical area is in Holland. Now, Holland is at this time partly Catholic and partly Calvinist Protestant. They make laws against St. Nicholas, against St. Nicholas fairs, but parents and kids cling on to the legend. And there will still be the St. Nicholas cult kept alive in Holland. Now, this is important because Holland is an imperial power, a colonizer. And in the 1600s, they bring the story of St. Nicholas to the east coast of North America, to what they call New Netherlands and their little settlement of New Amsterdam. And on the island of Manhattan and up the Hudson River, Dutch settlers bring the giant cookie presses to make St. Nicholas cookies with them and the legends of St. Nicholas. And when this area is conquered by the British and becomes New York, English-speaking America has within it the seedbed of this legend. So we now have St. Nicholas in America, largely ignored by everybody who isn't Dutch.
Right, right.
But now we come to part two of the story, which is that Christmas in the English-speaking world had fallen on very bad times. It had been abolished for a while in England during the Puritan Revolution. It was abolished in Scotland entirely. And it had fallen into the hands of rural bumpkins and urban drunks. The elites had nothing to do with Christmas. If they wanted to exchange presents, they did so at New Year's. So American cities, Philadelphia, Boston, New York, during the Christmas season, the nighttime is taken over by urban gangs of guys making raucous music to disturb the sleep of the law-abiding bourgeoisie. They'll attack immigrants. They'll attack African-American churches. They'll make nuisances of themselves. So a group of New York writers and historians and poets and artists loosely conspire in the early 1800s to try and tame Christmas, to bring it indoors, to domesticate it, to remove the alcohol and center it on children. And to do so, they revive St. Nicholas. They take the Dutch legends, publicize them, and make northeastern United States aware of his presence. So we've got this oral legend that now becomes literacized. Washington Irving writes about the Dutch history and tells stories of Santa Claus or St. Nicholas flying over the town, dropping gifts down the chimney. But the real explosion comes in 1820 with an anonymous poem called A Children's Friend. And this unknown artist and poet take the St. Nicholas legend, move him from his saint's day to Christmas Eve, take him out of the bishop's costume, and put him in a red and white fur suit, takes away his horse and cart, and puts him in a reindeer-powered sled. Only one reindeer, and a sled that bears the label, I think, Gifts, and has a nice bookshelf in it for literate kids. And it talks about this adult-sized gift bringer sneaking into children's homes and leaving gifts for good kids and a switch in the stockings of bad kids with which their parents may beat them. Now, this is an absolute revolution. This unknown artist and poet, or maybe two separate people, have secularized St. Nicholas and called him Santa Claus. We know that's his name because it's written on his hat. S-A-N-T-E-C-L-A-U-S. Clearly taken from the Dutch Sinterklaas, St. Nicholas. And this poem is not terribly well known, but it inspired a much better known poem the next year, which we call A Night Before Christmas, by Clement Clark Moore, who writes about a fur-clad elf, shrinks him in size so he can come down the chimney, and this sleigh is there, but now it's powered by eight reindeer. The magic of this is the poem is much lovelier, much easier to memorize, but it also the St. Nicholas in that is in no way judgmental. He gives the narrator to know he has nothing to fear. He leaves no lumps of coal or horse manure or switches. So this just explodes. It becomes the most reproduced poem in the English language, and the cult of Christmas gift bringer named Santa Claus, alternatively Saint Nick, but Santa Claus becomes increasingly the name, takes off in the northeastern United States, spread by the Civil War and by the cartoons in Harper's magazine of a German immigrant cartoonist named Thomas Nast, who gives the world this shaggy, sweet-natured, grandfatherly figure. So there you go. There's the infancy and early youth of Santa Claus.
Well, that's a great rundown. So there's a couple of things that you have brought up there that I would like to unpack, and a couple of things that I also hadn't really thought of before, and I want to see if I have your interpretation of this right. So I'll start with this. The Christkindle, the flying baby Jesus who comes around on Christmas Eve and gives out presents, you're kind of saying was a bit of a failure, didn't quite catch on the way maybe it had been intended to. I'd never really thought of the idea that one of the reasons for moving the visit from St. Nicholas from St. Nicholas Day to Christmas Eve was part to appease the kind of Protestant ethic of anti-papal, anti-pagan, right? Roots. Do I have that right? Is that what you're arguing here?
Well, I would say it's an anti-papal move. They had also the choice of New Year's Eve. It was traditional in much of Europe to give gifts on New Year's Eve, and the French still emphasize that day more than others. Or they could have done it on Epiphany, when the wise men arrived. But if you put the focus on the baby Jesus, then it's got to be December 24th, 25th. Mm. And I wouldn't say that it's in any way a failure, because the Christkindle and Le Petit Jésus are still major figures in France and Germany. And if we get a chance, we can talk about the anti-Santa Claus movement that took place in the late 20th century to bring back St. Nicholas and the Christ Child and to evict the American interloper Santa Claus, just as Eastern Europe had evicted the Soviet-imposed Grandfather Frost.
Yeah, well, I want to get there for sure. But I'm going to go back in time now for a second, because I want, as an historian, I'd like to get a little bit of your own perspective on the historicity of St. Nicholas himself.
Sure.
So one of my favorite stories as a religious studies person is the story of St. Nicholas punching Bishop Arius in the face in the Council of Nicaea, which I've heard various conflicting accounts as to whether how historical that actually is. I kind of take for granted that the story of the three chopped up boys who are miraculously resurrected after 7 years or whatever it is. There's just so much. Clearly, that's a myth. But the story of the daughters being sold into prostitution strikes me as far more plausible and far more consistent with the cultural sort of landscape at the time. What should we take seriously about the story of St. Nicholas, or is the whole thing just a giant sort of mythic construct?
Well, we don't have actually any record of him appearing at Nicaea. We do have lists of those who appeared. Now, whether it's complete or not, we don't know, but he's not on it. Hmm. In 1969, I think, Paul VI demoted St. Nicholas, along with St. Christopher, as being saints of less than ironclad historical veracity. So certainly there are doubts about it. But what strikes me as interesting is that so many of these legends get attached to him so quickly. They're not legends that have to wait centuries. They're legends of late antiquity. And Nicholas becomes one of the first saints who wasn't a martyr. So it's a whole new definition of sainthood that Nicholas gives. So I'm inclined to believe that he was a famous bishop, that his tomb was in Myra, and that he was remarkable enough for later centuries to attach all kinds of legends to.
Okay, so when we talk about Christmas and we talk about Santa Claus and his appearance and everything else, you've traced it from Turkey, right, where we get Nicholas through the Middle Ages into the New World. But what are some of the other cultural traditions and some of the other major cultures, either pre-Christian or post-Christian, that have played into the creation of this holiday that is so centered around children and gift giving and, you know, tidings of joy and so forth, that you think still deserve to be taken into account?
I'm of two, not two minds, but maybe two sides of the Christmas coin. One is that every culture in a temperate zone is going to have a midwinter feast. And it's going to feature light and heat, because it's the darkest time of the year, and you want to hope that there will be a renewal of the sun. Secondly, that it will feature greenery, because it's the bleakest time of the year. And so any kind of greenery that still exists out there, like holly, you want to bring into your place of worship and your house. And thirdly, feasting and plenty. This is the time in the agricultural year where there's no work to be done. The harvest is all in. It's been made into bread and cakes and beer. All the animals that can't be wintered over have been slaughtered. The fish pens, the eel pens have been empty. This stuff doesn't keep. You've got to eat it now. So every temperate culture is going to have midwinter festival. And it's going to have similar kinds of elements. Now, some have argued that because December 25th was chosen as the date for Christmas, that it is in some way an heir to Roman pagan holidays of the time. You've got Saturnalia, Brumalia, the Calends, and so on. And that's the history of religions theory. That used to be a very popular theory. It's now been shoved to the background by the calculation theory that suggests that December 25th was chosen for a number of arcane connections dealing with the creation of the world and the establishment of the Annunciation, the date of Mary's pregnancy, to March 25th. The notion that at the time that the early church would have anything to do with pagan customs, I think, goes against the grain. Later on, there's all kinds of appropriation that takes place when Christianity is more secure and they're evangelizing the pagans. So they're not afraid to take non-Christian customs and to put a Christian gloss on them.
It could be a little bit of both, though, right? I mean, it's you know, it strikes me that the argument that Christmas is 9 months after the supposed conception of Jesus, you know, it feels a little too convenient, as you know, to be placed right into this sort of midwinter celebration thing. And also, I mean, the fact that, you know, Christmas itself wasn't really a big deal for you know, quite a while in early Christianity. It was all about the resurrection and not so much the birth. So is there a sort of compatible account there that you know, it's sort of, this is just how religious motifs kind of play out?
In the argument for December 25th is much more complicated than that, and I usually forbear from giving it because it's a little wacky. You should also remember that December 25th had to be argued for. The Eastern cities, based on the same calculation, but different dates for Easter, churches in Antioch and Jerusalem and Alexandria and Constantinople, all chose January 6th as the date. So it took a lot of persuading from Gaul and North Africa and Rome to convince Eastern Christianity that December 25th was the deal. And one of the arguments was, hey, we got the paperwork. Mm-hmm. Look, in Rome, we've got got Joseph's taxation certificate. Probably not, but interesting argument.
So let's move north. A lot of the imagery around Christmas and around Santa Claus is obviously sort of Nordic, right? Mm-hmm. That he lives somewhere in the North Pole. Finland thinks they know where.
Oh, don't get me started on the Finns.
Oh, maybe I will now. Okay, so, what do you make of the Nordic celebration of Yule and mm-hmm. the idea of how the Norse god Odin or the English god Woden mm-hmm. worked himself into the DNA of Santa?
That's interesting. That's mostly a folklorist and Nazi contribution.
Whoa, okay.
Yule isn't an exact date. It's a whole season starting in November. And by the time we get these images of Norse gods, the mythology has been penetrated by Christianity. So it's always a bit dodgy, knowing how much, you know, the real Balder story or the real Odin hanging on a tree to get wisdom story is untouched by Christian examples. The notion that Christmas is a northern thing only comes in the 19th century. And it appears within those two poems in New York City in the early 1820s. And from then on, you have to remember, this is before global warming. The world is still in the little ice age. And it's natural to think of a December holiday in the temperate zone as having to do with ice and snow. So that's why I think the reindeer poem is so influential. All of a sudden, we get poets and artists emphasizing the fur, trying to locate Santa Claus somewhere. Iceland was the first suggestion in a mountain of ice. And then Nast and another poet nail it down as the North Pole. And then in the 1920s, the Finns come along in an act of unrivaled cultural imperialism and claim that he lives on Mount Ear. And they have convinced much of the world that this is so. I'm just absolutely furious. When the World Santa Claus Congress is held in Copenhagen every year, the Santa Clauses from all the world come, but the Finnish one won't, because he's the only genuine one. The rest are imitations. And they've made a wonderful industry out of it. And I'll take this opportunity to recommend the third best Christmas movie ever, which is a Finnish one based on this legend of Mount Ear. And the movie's called Rare Exports.
Oh, yeah.
It's a wonderful movie. Little horror movie. Very funny, very sweet. And it'll tell you about the Finnish connection to Santa Claus.
So the there's a rumor or a legend that one of the reasons why Santa in the Moore poem has eight reindeer is a reference to, I think it's Sleipnir, the flying horse of Odin.
Yeah, but also Gnasher and Cracker, the two goats that pull his cart.
Oh, okay. So you think that that is a genuine?
Well, I think in terms of names of the reindeer, that Moore probably had that in mind.
Huh. Okay. So we're in the new world. We have this highly kind of Americanized capitalist Santa, right? Who arrives on Christmas Eve and not on St. Nicholas Day, who has these sort of pagan elements to it. When does Santa get to be fat and and have the, you know, the red suit and the, sure. and the white beard. Moore describes him as, you know, sort of jovial and
jolly
having
old
a belly,
yeah.
Right? But as an elf, as a diminutive figure, I think in some of the early illustrations, he's even very, very, like a very small character. That's how he gets down the chimney. How does Santa get big? What made that happen?
It's a debate that artists and poets engage in for all of the 19th century. It's not until around 1900 that we get a standardized view of Santa. In the poem A Children's Friend that starts off the Revolution, he's a full-sized adult. Then Moore shrinks him. If you're going to have him come down the chimney, he's got to be somehow chimney hole-sized. But through the 19th century, you've got Santa as young, as old, as bearded, beardless, dressed like a peddler. That's what Moore says. My favorite is a publicity handout for P.T. Barnum's sponsoring of the visit of the Swedish operatic singer Jenny Lind, called Jenny Lind and Santa Claus, in which Santa Claus is dressed like George Washington with wings on his boots, and he flies around on a magic broomstick. He appears in dressing gowns, short jackets, long jackets. And though Nast gives him the face, that face becomes standardized pretty quickly. After the 1860s, his head is always going to be that lovely grandfatherly bearded figure. Mm-hmm. But the size varies, and his clothing is going to vary. Nast put him in a very unbecoming set of fur long johns. But by 1900, you've got the North American Santa Claus, Canadian and American, in a short fur-lined jacket, red trousers, fur-trimmed hat, boots. And in Europe, Père Noël, Der Weihnachtsmann, Father Christmas, wears the same red and white, but it's a longer robe with a cape and a hood. And those two have remained pretty unchallenged for the 20th century. The notion that Coke has anything to do with it is a legend not discouraged by the Coca-Cola company.
Sure.
But it comes from those wonderful ads starting in the 1930s by Haddon Sunblom, Chicago advertising artist. And the ads were omnipresent. They were just everywhere. So it was natural for people to associate this very red-faced, obese character with Santa Claus. But it's really based on earlier standardization. And in fact, Coke wasn't even the first soft drink company to use Santa. That goes to the White Rock Beverage Company of upstate New York, who used Santa during World War II and during Prohibition to tout their soft drinks.
Huh. I want to talk about one of the big controversies of recent years, and that is Sinterklaas's black-faced friend.
Right.
Which its proponents will say, oh no, it's a cultural tradition, and he's got his face is blackened because of all the soot from going down the chimney, which strikes me as thoroughly disingenuous. What do you make of the controversy of is it Black Peter, is that his name?
Swarte Piet. Yeah. Holland is certainly divided on this. It's really fighting words. I mean, if the Dutch were pistol packing people, there would be bodies on the saloon floor over this one. The figure seems to come from memories of the Spanish occupation of the Netherlands in the 15 and 1600s, and the appearance of North Africans. in the Spanish contingents, Moors. Now, the legend either has that he was a willing servant of St. Nicholas, or that he was a demon that had been tamed by St. Nicholas. But the sooty business is right out. He was a pure black. Mm. A terrible controversy arose a few years ago with the some self-appointed United Nations creature arriving and telling the Dutch that this was all terribly racist and they had to abolish him. In fact, abolish St. Nicholas too, because really you've already got Santa Claus. And that official was literally run out of Holland, lest violence be enacted. The Dutch are coming up with all kinds of compromises. You're now having cheese-colored peats in places like Gouda. Hmm. That sell cheese, or rainbow-colored ones. I think there's going to be a place for polka dot ones as well. I think there'll be a place for sort of black peat as well as rainbow peat and polka dot peat. Huh. And so on. When the Dutch dig their heels in, they're very stubborn people.
So earlier you alluded to the efforts to kill Santa Claus, and the war on Santa, as it were. What are some of the ones that people should know about?
It's quite a 20th century phenomenon. If you have a government that is totalitarian, you're not going to want a holiday that celebrates a god that is superior to Mao Zedong or Stalin or Hitler. So you're going to have to deal with Christmas in some way or other. Now, that means you're going to have to deal with Santa Claus. So the Chinese Cultural Revolution just abolishes Christmas and everything altogether. The Soviets cleverly take advantage of a calendar anomaly and shift all of the midwinter festivities to New Year's. Now, because the Soviet Union adopted the modernized Gregorian calendar and the Orthodox Church clung to the Julian calendar, which was by that time, I think, 12 days out of whack, in the Soviet Union, secular New Year's occurred before Christmas. So the state arranged that all the goodies for midwinter festivities, all the trees and the food, were available for December 31st, but were all gone by January 7th. And they replaced Santa Claus with a secular figure called Grandfather Frost, who had been the subject of poetry in the 19th century. Also, they gave him a New Year's boy, and a very attractive blonde lady claiming to be his niece. So it's a bit dubious. Snigarochka, snow maiden. It's very interesting how New Year's holidays all become about the future. And so it became very space age oriented, the Soviet Christmas. And St. Nicholas was quite eclipsed. In Nazi Germany, the Nazis were divided as to how to deal with Christmas. They feared it, but one branch said, Germans are so Christmassy, we're never going to get rid of it. What we should do is just kind of appropriate it and be there, you know, at the town nativity scene, make sure there's a Nazi official escorting Mary and Joseph to the cradle and so on. But the real hardliners, particularly in the SS, so said, no, we're pagans, genuine pagans. We got to get rid of it. And so they moved the festivities to midwinter, December 21st, and had bonfires and manly dances in the mountains and replaced St. Nicholas and the Christ child with one of St. Nicholas's shaggy helpers, Knecht Ruprecht. And then they morphed him into Wotan. So they genuinely paganized Christmas. One of my favorite substitutions of Santa Claus is the attempt in Mexico in the 1920s, which was very had a very anti-clerical, anti-Catholic revolutionary government to replace Saint Nicholas with a Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent god. And they erected a anyway, that one didn't go
I can't understand why. Why
anywhere.
would
No.
you not want a giant feathered snake in your house
Serpent
every
coming down your chimney. Yeah, there was a similar attempt in Brazil to create an indigenous multiracial figure from the jungle, and that was too frightening as well.
So a couple final questions. One is, you've been able to trace the history of the evolution of Santa as a cultural mythic construct. Is there anything that you see kind of happening today that you think will influence the Santa of the future?
That's a really good question. There are numerous attempts on the part of Hollywood and on the part of corporations to get a piece of the action. Corporations are always trying to associate themselves with Christmas and to start new traditions. That's been totally unsuccessful, except for the invention of Rudolph by a Chicago department store. Numerous other department stores tried to get in on it. Eaton's department store in Canada had Pumpkinhead, the sad little bear, and there was Uncle Mistletoe and Aunt Holly. Another anyway, so that didn't work. And Hollywood is always trying to adapt the Santa Claus legend, and they went through a phase, lasted about 15 years, of how does Santa Claus die? How is he replaced? And so you've got the famous Santa Claus movies with Tim Allen, but they've just not stuck. He's been given twins, one good, one evil. The legend is set in stone. I have yet to see anything that's going to chip away at it, and I would doubt if there's anything on the horizon that's going to challenge it. It is such a conspiracy on the part of parents. That's who runs the Santa Claus show. It's not not capitalism. It's not the church. It's a family conspiracy that each generation perpetuates, and it is so valuable to them that I can't see it being changed.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up the kind of dynastic Santa Claus motif because I hadn't thought that much about it, but there's a movie that came out last year that my daughters loved called Noelle, where Santa's daughter takes on the role. And there's Arthur Christmas, which is a wonderful movie, where you have this Santa dynasty. And it's a strange thing. I don't really quite understand why that needs to be inserted as a plot point into the Santa story.
Let me pause here just to kick in the shins, the elf on the shelf.
Which my daughters also love, but
Oh no. Talk about the all-seeing saint, yeah, the or surveillance economy.
Well, but it's, I mean, to be fair, I've heard the argument that it gets children ready for a surveillance state. But at the same time, when I was growing up, I was told that Santa starts observing my every move miraculously on December 1st. And it's the same thing. I was very cautious about, all the moves I would make in December in order to get sort of as much good list credit as I possibly could. I didn't need an elf. I admit that the task of moving it to a different location every night in December, sometimes I fall short of and have to explain away. But yeah, I don't have any feelings one way or the other towards the elf. My daughters love it, and what can I do? Okay, so last thing I want to ask you. You dropped a little bit of a carrot on the what you call the third best Christmas movie. So it's time to lay down the gauntlet on perhaps the most controversial topic in Western civilization.
No, it is not. No, no, it is not. It is not a Christmas movie.
I know. Okay. Correct. Good. All right. Moving on from that. Die Hard is not a Christmas movie. No, done. I agree, and we are correct. What are the two best?
I would say the Scrooge, 1951, with Alistair Sim, mm-hmm. in the black and white. Mm-hmm. Don't go for the colorized version. And the second one is a Fred McMurray, Barbara Stanwyck, 1940 or 41, Remember the Night.
Wow.
Anyway, very, very, very nice. And the ending is not the cheesy movie that you'd expect. You know, there's lots of other good ones. It's a Wonderful Life, though that's scarcely a Christmas movie.
Yeah.
Miracle on 34th Street, the original one.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
I like Ernest Saves Christmas.
That's a bold choice. Yeah, I think Elf is among the new ones, probably you know, up there.
Yep.
But so you list an adaptation of A Christmas Carol, and one more thing I kind of want you to set the record straight on, not specifically about Santa Claus, although some would argue that he does make an appearance in the form of the Ghost of Christmas Present. Yeah. Washington Irving has an enormous amount of influence over the entire sort of American psyche, which is a whole different topic. But where does Charles Dickens fit into this picture?
My goodness. Yeah, it's amazing that we got that far without mentioning Dickens.
Yeah.
If the New York artists and poets and NAST rescued Christmas in America, Charles Dickens and carol collectors and the Oxford movement saved it in Great Britain. 1843, his novella or novelette, A Christmas Carol, it just went viral. Three different versions on the stage at the same time, dozens of pirated editions, and he makes it an industry. Turning out Christmas books and Christmas stories of decreasing value every year. Yeah, he really hit gold with A Christmas Carol. And what he does there is to reconnect the conviviality of Christmas with deeper spiritual meanings, even though religion is scarcely openly mentioned in the book. If you take a look at his previous mention of Christmas in A Pickwick Papers, it's the very Washington Irving sort of country Christmas. But A Christmas Carol makes redemption, resurrection, family, forgiveness much more important. And I think that's why people love it so much. I still get tears in that version when the repentant Scrooge enters the drawing room of his nephew, and there's that moment of tender reconciliation.
It's a good place to leave it. Jerry Bowler, thank you so much. It's been really fascinating and insightful, and I wish you a very Merry Christmas.
And the same to you. It's been a hoot.
Gentlemen.